Good morning and welcome to The Warehouse. My name is Emily Winicky and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce the TM member whom will introduce this morning's speaker. Stan Linhorst is a lifelong journalist with a 44-year career in print and digital media. He retired in 2017, but continues to write, including weekly column, Conversations on Leadership for Syracuse.com and the Post Standard. Stan held a number of positions in Syracuse, including 15 years as senior managing editor and the company's director of new media. He also launched Syracuse.com in 1994. Stan participates in a variety of other community groups and was especially active as a volunteer and supporter of his children's church, school, and community activities. Please join me in welcoming Stan Linhorst.
Thank you, Emily. Thank you, everybody, and good morning. And you don't need to know much about me because so many of you know me. We see each other every Thursday. More importantly, though, today I'd like to introduce our speaker, Aileen Gallagher. Here's what you need to know about Aileen. She is an associate professor of journalism at Syracuse's Newhouse School. She teaches classes in reporting, writing, and editing. She researches changes in journalism education and also at the intersection of media and emerging technology. She graduated from SU in 1999 with dual degrees in journalism and history. She moved to New York City. And I'm happy to report that Aileen told me her reporting internship at the Post Standard helped her to land her first job. Terrific. In New York, she had a variety of journalism jobs. She rose to be senior editor for New York Magazine. She was also on the New York Magazine team that launched the magazine's website, and it won a bunch of awards. She ran the magazine's, this is magazine now, ran the magazine's first video department. Through her career, Aileen was mainly an editor, but she also contributed to coverage of books, politics and culture, TV and movies, even fashion. She was especially fond of interviewing authors, and I learned from Aileen that David Sedaris, now get this, David Sedaris says the barbershop at the Syracuse Airport is one of his favorites. So I'm gonna have to check that one out. Aileen came back to teach at the Newhouse School in 2010. Today, she's going to talk about the changing world of journalism. Basically, she'll tell us what worries journalists in 2018. And you know, it might worry you too, because she'll talk about diminished local news coverage and how Google and Facebook took away the economic underpinnings of good newspaper-style journalism. She'll talk about other economic pressures as well, and the cultural and political pressures on journalism. The polarization of the public and how that shapes where people get their news and what they believe and trust. So there's a lot to cover, so please welcome Aileen Gallagher.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here and speaking to you, and I'm very excited because my old professor and mentor, Peter Muller, is here to fact check me. So I hope I do everything right. So there's a lot of things that worry journalists. There's a couple things that give us hope. I could talk about what worries journalists for far more time than we have, so I'm giving you kind of the high level, big problems in hopes that we'll leave time for questions, especially since our current events from literally the last 2 days or so are also affecting journalists. So one of the things that really worries journalists, I think, is this notion of public distrust. When I was growing up, I was raised in a two-newspaper family with respect for journalists. My parents were conservatives, but they were New York Times subscribers and believed that what was in the paper was true. And increasingly, people don't believe that anymore. And so it becomes a big challenge, for our country and for even our community sometimes about, what do you do when you report the news and no one believes it? And there's a lot of sources of public distrust. The biggest source, I think, right now is our president, and who continuously, even in the face of journalists being murdered, journalists being threatened, continues to suggest that essentially what journalism he disagrees with, or stories he doesn't like, are inaccurate, and that reporters are biased, and they are making things up. And I think I'll get into transparency in a little bit, but I think that's part of the problem too, that it's easy to say, well, you're just making this up, because largely the public doesn't understand how journalism works, because journalists have been really lousy about telling our own story. And our perceptions have changed over time. So this is a recent poll, I think from 2017. So about two-thirds of Americans believe that the news that they are exposed to is biased. Going out of the gate, they just think that whatever they're exposed to is biased. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean wrong. And bias is actually, the technical definition of bias is repeated unfair treatment. So an article isn't necessarily biased, but a news source can be biased over how they're presenting information over time. And so the public, just going out of the gate, thinks that about two-thirds of what they read or hear or see, and this is biased, and this is seeping down. Even, you know, we used to maybe distrust national news outlets, but we did trust our local news outlets because we knew those people. And increasingly that distrust is seeping in to local news as well. And then our own habits. So this was fascinating to me. This is from 2018, the Pew Research Center, which does really excellent work about media and how Americans are thinking about media. So I know this is small. 68% of Americans say that they're getting their news on social media. 68%. But then they also believe that 57% of those people also believe that the news they're getting is largely inaccurate, and they continue to go there for that news source anyway. So where we get our news makes a huge difference in terms of how we think about it. We are prone to distrusting it, and yet we can't stay away from this thing that we are inherently suspicious of. And that also, the way that social media works is it kind of lends itself to business problems for news media that I'll talk about in a second. Because money is one of the things that journalists are really worried about. We've always been worried about how lousy our pay was, but that sort of came with the job, and we accepted that. But now it's a matter of, is there enough money to keep doing this? Because journalism is expensive. It costs a lot of money to send people out to get information. It takes time. Even if you're just sitting there writing, that's somebody's salary and health insurance and so forth. But good journalism usually takes time. So I want to show you the kind of contrast in where our money is these days. So this big bar up here is revenue from digital advertising. So all the total ad money spent on digital advertising is about $111 billion. Which sounds like quite a lot, and it is, so hold that thought for a second because it'll come up later. Television is making about $70 billion, radio is making about $14 billion, and then my good friends in the newspaper and magazine world are making a little under $10 billion a year in advertising revenue. So that's the pool of money that we're working with. This is just going to go down. It's already gone down quite a bit. It's just projected to go down even farther. So 2018, as I just said, our newspaper and magazine friends are making about $18 billion in ad revenue. That's expected to drop by almost half within the next 5 years. So it's just going to get worse as the money disappears. Because again, reporters cost money. Information for, you know, databases costs money. To be able to travel to get a story costs money. And then you think, well, wait a second, I thought you said there was $111 billion in digital advertising. And there is. There is $111 billion in digital advertising. The question is, who's getting that money? So this is I teach a introduction to magazine business editorial and ethics class, and this is the one thing I really want my students to be able to take away because it really surprises them. So this is the percentage of annual digital display advertising revenue. So digital display advertising is anytime you see a pop-up ad or a banner ad or something, that's considered display advertising, and it is the most valuable advertising. The advertisers pay the most money for that. So what I want you to notice here is about 60% or so of all of the revenue, all of that $111 billion we just saw, goes to five companies in the United States of America. It goes to Facebook, it goes to Google, it goes to Verizon and Yahoo, it goes to Amazon, and a little bit goes to Twitter. 60% of that $111 billion goes to five companies in America. So the other 40% is what everybody else is fighting over. Scraps. Scraps, scraps, scraps. So the revenue, even if the digital advertising revenue continues to go up, which it will as our audience habits change, who is getting that money is not the journalism organizations, or not enough. So the advertising revenue model as we know it is completely broken, and no publisher should chase that money at all, because it's not worth it. They're not getting it. And this ownership question of who owns the media, that used to be the only way to make money in media was to own it, was the old joke. If you wanted to make money, you get to own the press. Otherwise, forget it. So we have, in our ownership problem, we have a loss of ad revenue because from what I just showed you. We have a lack of local ownership. This is a critical problem when you hear about the decline of local news. This is really where it's coming from, is this lack of local ownership. Newspapers especially used to be family owned. Starting in the 80s or so, I would say, Stan can fact check me on this one, the families, a few generations into the families, there was not enough money to sustain all of the cousins and everybody, and so they all got offers to, are you gonna make the company public or do you wanna sell it? And so many of them sold it. It happened, even the grand newspaper families, family that owned Dow Jones, that I'm blanking on the name of at the moment, they sold out. The Sulzberger family that owns the Times, they sold out. And they still have control over it, but still. The Graham family owned the Washington Post, they sold out. So many of those are sold out or went public or whatever. But at the local level, where communities used to have family-owned newspapers that were in the community for generations, they knew the people, they knew the problems, they knew the bad habits, they knew all the secrets. They sold to chains, and the chains have recently, in the last 10 years or so, 15 years or so, been bought up by hedge funds. Now, hedge funds are in the business of making a lot of money. They're very good at making a lot of money. They are not in the news business. And so largely what they're doing is they are essentially gutting the newspaper and selling it for scraps. How much profit can we squeeze out of this thing before we sell it to somebody else? And the consequences of that are, to a local community, if you have nobody watching, you have potential for corruption. You have potential for civil rights violations. You have potential for your schools to be going south and no one notices, public services. Any vulnerable people can be harmed and no one's watching out for them. And so that local ownership piece is really critical. And some of that ownership too now, at least on the broadcast side especially, is ideologically driven. So I don't have a slide up here, but overwhelmingly people trust local television news more than almost any other news source. And in the United States, we've had consolidation largely because we've let some communications laws go lax and ownership laws. So there used to be laws that prevented people from owning, like you couldn't own two newspapers in the same town, or you couldn't own a newspaper and a television station, or you couldn't own two television stations. And media companies have found a way around this. And the laws were there to protect the marketplace of ideas. You didn't want the same people owning the press, because then nobody, you know, who was going to be a check and balance on that? That's not really a concern that anyone in the federal government has anymore. So we've largely gotten, they've found ways to get away from those laws. So another visual here. So Sinclair Broadcast Group is a broadcasting company owned by a conservative family, and which in and of itself, that's fine. You want to own, everybody can own news, that's fine. So, but what Sinclair does is they have bought up many, many stations, and they have figured out a way to, they created shell companies, essentially, to be able to buy multiple stations in the same town. So on paper, it's as though they are two different companies that own the news organizations, but in reality, it's the same company. So Sinclair owns 193 stations in the United States, two here in Syracuse, Channel 5 and Channel 3 are Sinclair stations. And they are able to reach about 40% of Americans just by their how many stations they own. Because they are a fairly ideologically driven company, they put editorials on their local news stations that have nothing to do with local issues. They put a lot of package, I don't know if you've watched them lately, but they put a lot of package stories that aren't even from here, because it saves money. So they're kind of meaningless, like fluffy feel-good stories that are not even fluffy and feel-good in a way of which we know the person. We don't know them. I watched one the other day, and I was thinking, like, why is this on the news? Because it was in Tennessee, and it took me a while to figure out there's something wrong with the story, and I thought, oh, the accents are all wrong. And it was a story about these people in Tennessee who I didn't know and didn't care about, and which keeps me from knowing more about my own community. So the one good thing, I think, is that Sinclair tried to buy Tribune Broadcasting Group, and if they had bought Tribune, they would have owned, I think, have been able to reach about 80% of American homes. And even this administration's FCC decided, or it wasn't the FCC, I think it was the Federal Trade Commission, decided this is a little bit too much even for us. So that merger didn't go through. However, they're still controlling nearly 40%. That's huge reach. That's unbelievable reach. And if you look at the demographics of who's watching local news, older people are watching local news. Overwhelmingly, white people are watching local news. Tend to be more conservative who's watching local news. So, you know, we all talk about, at least in journalism, we talk about the big influence of Fox News. And the influence of Sinclair, I think, is possibly even greater, especially as you get fewer people who have cable television. So I don't have cable. I get all my stuff over, I stream it, but I do have a little antenna, and I watch a lot of local, I get all my local stations over my antenna. And so I watch local news. And the more and more people that you're going to get who are getting away from cable, they're not going to be able to watch Fox, but they are going to be able to watch Sinclair. So all that's very depressing, right? So what about the hope part? Is there any hope here? And I think there is, and I say that also because I teach young people, right? So they have fresh ideas and are very passionate and are very engaged. And I will say that one thing I have noticed, I don't know if there's been kind of what I would consider bogus trend stories in the news about whether journalism applications are up or down. The Newhouse School does just fine in applications, so I don't know if they're up or down that way. But I do know that this is my ninth year at Newhouse. In the past couple years, students have been much more interested in what I would consider more hard news, more policy stuff, more issues-based stuff. So that gives me quite a lot of hope. Another thing that gives me hope is new voices in journalism. So for decades, journalism, the magazine world at least, was controlled in the cities, was controlled mostly by people gone to the Ivy Leagues, Washington Post, New York Times, and even any national news organization, same thing. There was not a lot of room in the national conversation for people from underrepresented groups, people who went to public schools, things as simple as that. And so we've had a big shift, and I cannot tell you with a straight face that the media industry has solved its diversity problem, because it hasn't. It hasn't. I can tell you that it's getting slightly better, one, and two, that people care about it a lot more. So a new generation coming up, a generation that is much more diverse, a generation who is concerned about whose voices are getting heard, that are much more likely to cover stories for and about underrepresented groups. And the technology here is a big piece of this, because what you have is a technology in which, or technology that enables everybody to create content. So there is not the barrier to entry that there was even 10 years ago. And the thing that is solving that is a mobile device. If you have a smartphone in your pocket, you can produce media content. And the reason you can distribute it is because of Wi-Fi. And free Wi-Fi has done more to democratize technology in this country and in the world than any other device, any invention, anything. It's all about Wi-Fi. Without Wi-Fi, it's still inaccessible, unaffordable, whatever. Wi-Fi is what makes the digital world accessible to everybody. There's also new business models in journalism. And again, we're working on this. We're working on this one, but because, as I said, the advertising's not working out as well as it used to. So that business model doesn't make a lot of sense. To chase an audience, we spent a few years chasing scale. That was the buzzword in media. How many people can you get to come to your website? How many people can you get to read things? And eventually you run out of people. There's just not enough to make it sustainable. So we have to find new business models, because advertising is not going to be it. And whoever can figure this one out, they win. They get all the money, they get all the glory, because if you can figure out a business model that's going to save journalism, you're going to be fine. One thing that gives me hope in that area is that we have a cultural shift and a willingness to pay for content. Now, you all look like responsible people who pay for things, so I appreciate that. I appreciate that you subscribe to things. Young people for a long time did not, because why would you pay for something that you could get for free? And the media companies, foolishly, gave it to them for free. Because the media companies themselves, one of the things they did that really hurt them the most is they didn't value the digital material at all either. They valued print, because they knew print. And that's what they paid for, that's what they thought had a lot of value, and so the internet was kind of like, well, this is a stupid waste of money, and it's junk, and so we're gonna give it away for free. One of the only companies that didn't was the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal, when it launched in the mid-90s, they were always subscription-based. And they said, the rest of you are idiots. You should pay for this. People will pay. So we have now a generational shift where young people are learning how to pay. Young people are comfortable with paying for Netflix. Whatever their other streaming subscriptions are, this idea that if they want content, they pay for it. So increasingly, we have figured out ways to not, and we make up new words for old things to make them seem fancy and different. So now we don't just have subscriptions, we have memberships. So you can be a member of, you can be a member of the Atlantic magazine, and you get inside, fewer advertisements, I guess. You can get an email from an editor or something every once in a while. You can go to their fancy festivals, and so we this idea of a membership, and we're offering something to the audience more than just simply the content, because that also feeds into the sense of responsibility that I hope the public feels for journalism as it becomes increasingly threatened, and the consequences of those threats, which are now the consequences are actual violence. So this notion of journalism as a civic trust, which was always in the background, and when journalists, when you ask them, you know, why do you do what you do? And they say, well, I feel like I am doing a public good. It is a civic trust. It is all of those things. The rest of the public, I think, is increasingly starting to believe that it is a civic trust, that journalism is a civic, that the supporting journalism is a civic value, is a way to engage with your community, is a way to be responsible for participation in your democracy, to encourage quality journalism. So we in the media should really latch on to that and find ways to say, well, you know, if this is how you feel about journalism, then surely you will pay $50, or surely you will pay $100. And the hope is that some people will. Now, is that sustainable? I don't know. How many people are going to pay $50 or $100? But overall, we're finding new ways to make people to ask people to pay, and people are coming through. The trust piece is a little bit trickier in some ways than even the money, because money is just math. You figure out how to get people to pay for it, and is there going to be enough? But the trust piece is really critical, because if you don't have the public trust, then none of it matters anyway, right? And if we don't have the public trust in journalists, then how do we end up having public trust in our government? All these institutions that journalism tells us about, we lose public trust. And I don't know how you feel, but I'm not sure how I feel about a world in which I no longer trust the Congress, I no longer trust the Supreme Court, I no longer trust the business world, I no longer trust public education. That's a scary world to live in. If you don't feel that any of these institutions are out to do public good or care about anything except lining their own pockets, that's a real undermining of how we feel about America. And that's dangerous. So one of the things that journalists, I think, can do is build more trust by being more transparent. Historically, journalists have been great about asking other people, what do you do, how do you do it, explaining jobs, explaining roles, and we've been terrible at explaining how we work to the public. Part of it is because journalists are arrogant and say, well, you just have to trust that we did the work, right? That we did talk to the people that we said we talked to. So there's a big movement in journalism now to be much more transparent, to show your work, to say who you talked to, who you didn't talk to, why you tried to talk to them, to explain to people, you know, anonymous sourcing. That's what the president goes on about, anonymous sources. And they're not anonymous, they're just confidential. It's not like no one knows who they are, right? It's not as though someone just calls and says, you know, that guy's a jerk, and we say, okay, thank you, and then write it down. It doesn't work that way, right? That there's this idea of who are our sources, how are we getting them? If they need to be protected in some way, that we explain to the audience why they're being protected. And also, don't be so in such a hurry to use them. And that's a two-way street as well. There's a big problem in Washington about, and actually it's not even Washington, it's everywhere now, people who are technically the spokespeople for public organizations will talk to a journalist and say, don't put me on the record. Well, you're the spokesperson. You don't get to be off the record. Your job is literally to talk to me, to talk to the public. And sometimes we let people get away with that too much. So it's up to the journalists too. But we have to explain what we do and how we do it, because that's the only way we're going to get the public's trust back. And we have to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it and never stop. Audience engagement is a way to build trust. It was not a thing that I was ever taught to care about as a young journalist. We didn't hear from the audience that much. They were out there somewhere. I know the more local you worked, the more you were likely to hear from your audience. But I remember one time a professor telling me that whenever they got, he was the managing editor of the paper in Auburn, and he said, I never heard from the audience more than when we moved a comic strip. out of the paper. And I think we're doing all this great work, and everyone, the letters come in when people say, you know, where's the junior jumble? And so that was the only way that we ever used to hear from the audience. Now we can hear from the audience all the time. The question is, are we listening? Because journalists, as I said, are pretty smart people as a group. We can get a little bit arrogant. So the idea that the audience, you know, does the audience, what do they know? Well, they know a lot. And we need to engage with them more, because if you are in a constant conversation with your audience, they are more likely to trust you. They are more likely to tell you things that you don't know about that are important. And then the audience is more likely to believe you when you come out with the story, because they know you. You didn't just show up yesterday. You've been a part of the community. And finally, there's a trend in journalism right now known as solutions journalism, which is a change. Journalists have historically been really great at pointing out problems and identifying what's wrong in our culture. And so what solutions journalism tries to do is identify what's wrong, but also without making sure to include something that might fix that problem. Or identifying, before even you go to the problem first, what's the solution. So, you know, it's a good business practice that I don't understand why we haven't done for a long time, right? You never, I tell my students that you never bring a problem to your boss unless you also walk in with a solution. And journalists, for years, just pointed out problems, and then said, good luck with that, and moved along to the next problem. And so what we're doing now is becoming much more involved with identifying solutions in hopes that we can, again, build more of that public trust, and also spread good ideas. Spread ideas that work, policy ideas that work, education ideas that work. So there are other things that are giving us hope. I wanted to leave time for questions since there's much to discuss. So I open it to the floor. Yes, sir.
I don't know if I have a question or a comment, but just before I came over this morning, I listened to the president blame the recent terrorist incidents, the bombing, which we're all familiar with, I think, on the media. How do you establish trust when you get all of this rhetoric from the White House in blaming the media for what's going on now, or do you?
I think a good start would be to cover it a little bit less. The media covers the president. I mean, there is no more important person in the United States, if not the world. So I understand the tendency, but I think that because we cover every word as though it is all equally relevant or equally meaningful or equally impactful, elevates his language, elevates the rhetoric. And we get stuck in this trap that we keep covering it. And the president's no fool. He's a genius when it comes to media. He's great at it. And he's been great at it for years. And so he knows how to play the media, and the media continues to report on it all the time. And for a while, I was very encouraged because even Fox News stopped carrying rallies. I think last week they stopped for a couple days, and then it was on again. Excuse me, it was on again last night. And I remember during the campaign that I was shocked at how much airtime he got, and that's why he's president, because they kept putting him on television. You have a 24-hour news cycle; you have to fill it with something. So fill it with the circus, right? And so the media, and also too that there's this transparency problem. The public doesn't necessarily understand how journalism works because we've been so bad at telling them. So if you turn on the news in prime time, you are watching commentary. You are watching commentary. However, most of the public says they're watching the news, because it's on MSNBC, or it's on Fox, or it's on whatever. So, and so I don't blame them for that, right? The American people aren't stupid. It's just more of they don't have to necessarily think about these things this way. So I think if the media made a concerted effort to pull back on some of the coverage and maybe talked more about issues, then it might help a little bit. I will be interested to see in 2 years or another 4 years after that, depending on if the president gets reelected. You know, does this change our coverage of our leadership forever, or is this just a weird blip that we will all look back on one day and go, I'm not sure what happened there for a while. So I don't know, but I do think it's a coverage issue in how we're allocating our resources.
So earlier you were talking about bias, and I'm wondering the influence of male chauvinism within the media industry and world, and what impact do you think the Me Too movement has had now in terms of that phenomenon? I'm wondering if you're seeing any change in attitudes amongst the students that you're teaching.
Oh, well, I think that students, I don't know if the men are necessarily changing their behavior as much as the women are now speaking up about it. It's very interesting, this generation of students, and the generation that's coming up now, the millennials are kind of they've all graduated, and now we're on to Generation Z. And there's several books about it that are just hot off the presses if you want to learn all about what's up with Generation Z. And one of the things I find is that they have much better idea of, they're pretty set on what they believe and what they think is right. And even students who are, and I teach Democrats, I teach Republicans, I teach Libertarians, I teach all kinds of people. So even the students who are who I wouldn't label liberal or wouldn't label progressive have very certain ideas of what their social values are, and their social values are actually pretty liberal. And that could be that's for many reasons, I think. They're exposed to a much more diverse world than they're used to be. They are used to seeing women in more positions of power, which I think really helps young people. And anytime you see representation of yourself, anybody that you can identify with in a leadership role, in a position of power, is hugely influential. But we do talk about how people should behave versus how people do behave. And I mean, I'm very encouraged. I think of things that went on in places that I worked when I was younger, and that's how that was. So, and I don't think the students are standing for that anymore. I don't know if the behavior's changing. That's a little bit different. But I do know that the conversation is out there a lot more, and that people are a lot more demanding of they have higher expectations of how they should be treated. And my students, I will say, are very concerned about being respectful to sources in a way that I don't think journalists necessarily have been in the past. I had a student who was doing a story about how the conversation among young people about sexual assault had changed following the Kavanaugh hearings. And she was very concerned about the interviews that she was doing with people who may have experienced some kind of trauma. And so we talked about that, about how to cover that. And I don't know if that's necessarily a conversation I would have had a few years ago, right? That she was even sensitive to that and brought that concern to me. It wasn't anything I had to raise with her, but she brought that to me. And I think that's been a big change.
I was impressed by your map of ownership, because there was this great big white swath of America from Montana to Texas that was not owned by, see that? And I was out in Montana this summer, and I was expecting a whole different news scene there. But in fact, it was very traditional. It was very much like when I was a child in Montana. The local issues, as you said, were covered in newspapers in depth. There was a lot of, when I went around the state, a lot of in-depth reporting. And to me, that's a hopeful sign that where, obviously, these companies have looked at states like Montana and Wyoming and said there's not a lot of people there, there are not a lot of eyes there. so we're not going to conglomerate there. Do you agree, or do you see that there is hope in these places where the media conglomerates have
ignored? We should go to sparsely populated areas where we are spared.
Yes.
I think that's a good idea. I might look into that. I don't know, because I'm thinking about the papers in Montana, and I think maybe the state has, I don't know, one paper pretty much. Is it the Missoulian? I mean, I think that there has to be a commitment, right? There has to be a commitment to support journalism, and it can be really challenging to do that sometimes. You know, even I'm challenged by the publishing habits of our local paper, because by the time I would pay for it if they gave me a good way to pay for it. I actually don't subscribe to it anymore, which is very upsetting to me. I don't subscribe to it anymore because by the time I got the paper, I had already read everything in it. So I couldn't, it had literally no value to me. And when I called to cancel, the poor woman on the phone, she was very nice, and she said, I said, you know, when I get the paper, I've already read it. You're not telling me anything new. And she said, well, there's a lot of coupons in there. And I said, yes, there are. But if that's the best you can do, then I'm sorry. I'm not paying to get 39 cents off. So they themselves cannot come up with a product. And I would happily pay. You know, if the Post Standard said, if you want a digital subscription, pay $50 a year, whatever it would cost to pay for it, I would pay for it. Just give me a way to buy it. I will buy it. So I think it's really challenging sometimes, even in places where people want to support the media, to find ways to support it in ways that also, you know, address the fact that they're customers. So I'm not sure of the ownership situation in Montana or really in that whole swath. I bet it does have to do a lot to do with population. It's just critical that the media come up with ways, even on the local level, to make a product that people want to pay for.
One follow-up regarding Sinclair Broadcasting. I don't mean to plug this, but there's a very good article about Sinclair in a recent New Yorker magazine.
Yes, there is.
If you have any interest in a very detailed, a very good review of its history, what it does, its political underpinnings, how it ducks this agglomeration issue, how they structure themselves. It's an excellent, excellent article, I thought. Regarding the local paper, I still subscribe because otherwise I'd miss the full-page hearing aid ads and the obituaries. I mean, what could be better? It's a very discouraging publication these days. Finally, I think you made the remark that Americans aren't stupid. I don't know. We like to be entertained. And as you point out, this president has a capacity to entertain with his commentary. And particularly if you're entertained in something that's rooted in your biases, it has a powerful effect on where people go to what they watch and what they engage. And that's in part why Fox News, I think, has such a dominant percentage of people who do watch that station on a regular and continuing basis. And finally, you look at this map, and we're talking about Sinclair as being a conservative organization. That's just, I guess something I ask myself, why isn't there a liberal organization buying stations? What is it about how people, what they want to see in that kind of media where the conservative method of presenting seems to be able to march across the country on a sustainable business model and the liberal electronic media cannot?
Historically, liberal radio, there was a while, prior to the rise of Fox News, there was conservative radio, which is really where the conservative media movement starts, starting in the 80s, and gaining a lot of traction. We don't hear about Rush Limbaugh that much anymore because he's been displaced by Fox News, essentially. But so in the early 2000s, I think that there was a kind of liberal attempt to create the same kind of radio, and there's still, I mean, some would say, well, you have NPR, and there's a little bit of truth to that in terms of just, they are certainly progressive in the way that they cover their stories. In terms of outwardly liberal, I forget what the name of the station was, or what the broadcast network was, but it failed. television or radio is not the way the future of progressives is young. The future of progressives is diverse. And so local news is not a way to reach that audience. They're not turning on the TV at 11 o'clock to see what's going on in their town. That's not where they're getting their information from. So to capture an audience in a similar way, it's a terrible value proposition for a media company, because the audience just isn't going to be there.
Thank you, first of all, for a very informative presentation. You talked about the importance of communication between the media and their audience. I hope you're not including in that the comment section next to the many articles that are online. I find it very offensive that newspapers now allow people to comment anonymously. Most of the comments, and I don't read them very often because they just annoy me. But every once in a while I go and look, and the comments are often ill-informed and just raw. They're really insulting, I think. And I don't understand why the Syracuse.com allows this. What happens in other media, daily newspapers or media outlets? Do they all do this now?
Commenting started to come to the forefront in about the mid-2000s. And part of, I think, the anonymity issue is that the early internet was an anonymous place, right? That people had screen names. There's that famous New Yorker cartoon, right? On the internet, no one knows that you're a dog. And so the whole technology was based in anonymity. And so when organizations first introduced commenting, and this was the first way that people were talking to each other, they did it anonymously. Now, what is the problem with that? You found out the problem with that anonymity apparently frees us to be our most vile selves. For sport, in some ways, I think. So places that have successful commenting systems, you have to use your name. You have to be a verified user somehow. And there's also a moderator. And it costs money to pay someone to sift out all the hate. It's also a very terrible job. I read a really great story once about someone whose job it was to be a YouTube moderator. And so people would flag videos on YouTube for offensive comments, or offensive content, and so they had to watch it and decide if it got to be on YouTube or not. And so the writer talked about what a psychologically damaging job that was. I can't imagine. And so you have to invest in a good commenting system to have a good one. I think the New York Times has a pretty good one. As artificial intelligence gets better, you can automate some of that, and because I think a lot of the places have done it for, they haven't moderated because of a lack of resources. So as the technology gets better, that might improve. Syracuse.com, to their credit, has done made some efforts to improve their commenting sections, which for a long time were extremely vile. And I think the troubling thing about it too is that's a tiny sliver of the audience. And the majority of people you're talking to are, you know, reasonable people who have other things to do in their lives than, you know, type angry things on their computer. So, but it is a cynical grab for page views. And that is still Syracuse.com's advertising model is the page view model, which is a pretty, in my opinion, outdated one. And one of the consequences of that, or how do you get people to come back? Well, if you're an avid commenter, then you're going to come back and come back and come back, and I can, you know, earn a couple pennies every time you do that. So it's a cynical model. But there are great commenting communities. New York Times has a good one. The Atlantic for many years had a really great one. Slate had a great one. But I'm proving the problem, right, is I'm telling you really great ones on news sources that I read, which if you looked at them, you would probably say, well, those are more progressive than they are conservative, which is true. And there's something else that I didn't include in here, but this idea of confirmation bias, right? That we continuously return to the sources that reinforce the ideas that we already have. That is a psychological phenomenon that is widely proven, and it makes it extremely difficult for you to change anybody's mind. You know, if I disagree with someone and their news is all coming from one source, and I say, well, why don't you read this article in the New Yorker that may give you some more information, they're going to tell me to shove it. Or else they're just going to read it and say, well, that's the biased media telling you that story, so it doesn't count. So it's extremely challenging. We're kind of we're trapped in this like psychological vice where it's very hard to get out of our own mode of thinking and learn something new.
Yeah, my question goes maybe dovetails with what you just talked about, but you had mentioned before in terms of building trust, you're moving away from just finding problems or what's wrong with the world. And coming up with solutions. I had too many interviews, whether it was radio, TV, print, that reporters were coming with already, I guess you could say, predefined story that they already probably wrote, for all I knew, and they really just wanted me to confirm and be able to be quoted for it to support that thesis, whatever it happened to be. I just get very frustrated because a lot of times their facts were all wrong and therefore what they ended up with was wrong. And I tried to explain that and they'd ask the question 10 different ways trying to get me to say something that would support their position. Is that changing at all where people don't come ready with the story that they want done and just wanted a quote from somebody?
I think a lot of it depends on time. So if you are a reporter for a daily news organization, then you go out, you have already kind of decided what the story is going to be, and then you go out and report that story and come back with the exact one that you thought it was going to be. So it's not a very enlightened process. I agree with you that that happens pretty frequently. And I think journalists tend to fall into a trap that way, where they don't start out doing it, and then that's sort of how it falls, and so you have to check yourself as a journalist and be willing to say, well, this story is not going the way I thought it was going to go, and so it has to be something different, and that has a lot again to do with time. If I go for a story and the story turns out to be something different, then I need time to do that correction, right? I need time to now do a bunch more research and find a bunch more sources and go where that story is telling me. And I also have someone else in my ear saying, well, you better be back here by 6 o'clock with the story because we're going on at 6:07. So that is not a new problem. It is an old problem, and it has a little bit to do with laziness or kind of lapsing into feeling pretty comfortable with things. And it is a constant source of frustration for the public. And I appreciate you trying to explain to the journalists what the story actually was. And I hear your frustration that they did not listen. And some people, you know, they just stopped doing interviews because of that. Because what's the point if you're just going to not listen to what I have to say anyway? And I've been on the receiving end of that, too. I was interviewed by a New York Times columnist once. And I remember during the call thinking, like, this is it. I am going to get my name in the New York Times as an expert, whatever. And he didn't like what I said, because he had a thesis, and I had a different point of view. And I talked to him for about 20 minutes, a half an hour. And I read the story when it came out 2 days later or something. And there was somebody else that I know had interviewed a bunch of times who said what fit his thesis. And it was enormously frustrating, and it was a great experience for me to be on the other end of that to realize what that feels like and how frustrating it is. And so I think it's lazy journalism. I think it's also journalism under terrible pressure and complacency, and that it is up to us as journalists to fight that a lot. And I think it's also really important for the public to call us out when we don't. And you know, say there, it's not a one-way thing in terms of who gets the media anymore, right? So if I am misquoted, if I there's a million ways for me to respond to that news organization and say publicly, you know, I talked to them about this, and the real story is such and such and such and such.
And this is a good segue question. I know I've also experienced that, and the one time I was quoted in the Washington Post was when I exactly gave them the quote they needed. And I knew it would be in there. I could almost predict it, you know. But my question is more about, I'm very interested in what you said about solutions journalism. And can you talk about what are some of the educational efforts that are being done in academia to ensure that people are knowledgeable enough to propose good solutions and maybe even to elaborate on them? I know when I've written in the past, I've called it advocacy, research and advocacy. You know, so how do we make sure that the journal, and my other pet peeve is editorially, you know, it just seems like websites and in articles, you see missing words a lot, you see misspellings. It just seems that for us older folks, I just seem to see them more and more. Is that true, or is that,
oh, that's
is that
true
just me noticing that?
No, that's
how do
true
we
because
end
the,
that?
because an editorial layer has been cut out. So newsrooms, like the people who fix the grammar and the punctuation and the spelling and all that stuff, those are copy editors and largely have been removed from newsrooms. They got laid off because the idea was, well, the reporter can do it themselves. Now, I am a very good writer. I have done it professionally for 20 years or a little more than that, and I still make typos even no matter how hard I try, right? So removing that layer is not very helpful. And that also furthers public distrust, you know, because even if I wrote your name down correctly in my notes and I just misspelled it or whatever when I typed it, if I misspelled your name, well, then what else did I get wrong, right? The details matter in this case because you're looking for a reason to either, you know, what gives the story credibility or what detracts from it. Solutions and advocacy, I would say, is a little bit different. Only because the advocacy piece makes people a little bit nervous, right? So the advocacy piece is saying, well, you've already decided what the position is or whatever, and you're going to report, you know, you're advocating for something in your reporting. And if you're advocating for something in your reporting, then perhaps you are leaving out information that may run counter to that. So advocacy, I'm a little like, about. Now, and there are some advocacy journalists who say, well, I only write about, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline, and that is, or I only write about segregation in education, and that is what I am advocating for, and the facts speak for themselves in this way, and that's certainly a conversation worth having with journalists. The solutions piece, I think, is a little bit, is getting a lot of traction in journalism education because it feels new, and also because it feels hopeful in some ways. And so where we are looking for solutions, and this also kind of feeds into audience engagement, at least on the local level, where we're looking for solutions is what are people in the community doing to solve their own problems? And so how are, and sometimes that might be something very small, right? It might be somebody, you know, doing tutoring 2 days a week in their for their next door neighbor, and what kind of change does that mean? And if we expanded this program, if they got some money and got some support and we expanded this program, you know, how could it change our community? So the solutions piece, I think, is also fits into the audience engagement, because in order to know what the community is doing to solve its own problems, you have to be plugged into that. It also tends to make a community feel better about itself when their local news organization is propping them up instead of constantly reminding everyone why everything is so terrible. So there's a sort of community building aspect to it that, again, also feeds into that idea of building up trust.
Great. Please join me in thanking Eileen Gallagher.
Thank you all. It's been a lot of fun.